in the occupied territories, which is happening right now, nor sanctions on Saudi Arabia for its air campaign in Yemen. Second, the sanctions themselves will actually range from halting arms sales to polite diplomatic engagement. Actually ending the abuse is an entirely different matter. Third, there is bound to be administrative debate over what constitutes a serious abuse. How many civilians have to die or be arrested without cause? Or how many villages have to be destroyed before the new policy comes into effect? Fourth is the bureaucratic dimension. The Pentagon, State Department, and other agencies will need to achieve consensus on abuses. They have different goals for military aid. For the Pentagon, the security threat is primary, while for state, military aid is supplemental to economic and humanitarian assistance. These differences are likely to lead to disputes over abuses and the range of punishments, depending on different assessments of the problem and the importance of relations with a particular country. Fifth, governments that use U.S. weapons often justify their use against civilians on familiar grounds, defeating terrorists and separatists, breaking up drug networks, preventing coups. Those governments will be lobbying for waivers, which will add to the bureaucratic wrangling and the administration's headaches. My guess is that the actual outcome of the Biden program will be that those countries least important to U.S. interests will receive the heaviest punishment. Strategically and economically important countries that systematically violate human rights using U.S. weapons will, as before, continue doing their dirty business. A more direct alternative to the new tracking program is available: congressional action to ban arms sales or transfers to human rights violators, such as the Senate and House have just done with Egypt. The ban puts the onus on the recipient country rather than on U.S. agencies. Meantime, one army that may violate human rights abroad or commit war crimes when using American weapons or training is not covered by the new program. Ours. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 10th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertow and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Catherine Carley, Jill Freitas, and Roz Brown. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. This September, the Coast Range Association, along with partners like 350PDX, Indigenous Environmental Network, Rainforest Action Network, the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, and many more, organized a major protest and counterconference in response to the Who Will Own the Forest Timber Investing Conference in Portland. If you aren't familiar with Who Will Own the Forest, I'd encourage you to listen to the episode we did a couple weeks back with Brenna Bell of 350PDX, which you can find by searching for Coast Range Radio on any podcast app or at our website, coastrange.org. The short version is that Who Will Own the Forest is an annual timberland investment conference, bringing together some of the world's biggest climate polluters, corporate forest clearcutters, finance giants, and false climate solutions peddlers. Just to name a few, you've got JPMorgan Chase, Weyerhaeuser, BP, TIAA, the list goes on and on, but you can start to get the idea. Tickets cost over $2,000 apiece, and attendees come from all over the world to scheme on ever more efficient ways to exploit communities and natural resources, sabotage efforts to decarbonize, and extract maximum profits for the 1%. Gross. So, in response, we staged a day-long protest outside the conference, which drew around 200 people, and the next day we held another day-long Forests Over Profits counter-conference, which was attended by roughly the same number of folks. Separately, there were also several groups of activists who blocked the entrance to the Who Will Own the Forest conference multiple times, making sure that those attending the event could not ignore our message. And I want to thank everyone who helped make the protest and conference such a huge success. There is clearly an appetite for taking on Wall Street's exploitation of forest lands, and I am so excited to see where this movement goes from here. If you want to learn more or get involved, you can email me at michael@coastrange.org. For the rest of today's episode, I'm going to be airing a few clips from our Forest Over Profits conference. And I'll be putting out another episode or two highlighting different presentations from that conference soon. So I'm releasing this episode on Indigenous Peoples Day, which is October 9th. So in honor of that, today's episode will focus on clips from some of our conference's Indigenous presenters, including an Indigenous Environmental Network panel discussion and a talk on the commercialization of huckleberries and other sacred foods. The Indigenous Environmental Network panel, in particular, was super powerful and inspiring, but I only have time to air a short segment of it for our radio edition. So I really encourage you to listen to their entire presentation. I'll be putting out the full discussion as a separate podcast, which you can find by searching for Coast Range Radio on any podcast app or again at our website, coastrange.org. We're going to start with a short welcome message from Gran Melosa, a Coast Salish elder who was a leader in the Fairy Creek old-growth logging blockades on Vancouver Island up in British Columbia. Unfortunately, we had audio issues during her speech, but her story and the devastating old-growth logging happening in Canada are absolutely worth learning more about. I'll have links to learn more about that and everything else discussed today in the podcast show notes and at our website at coastrange.org. Thanks so much for listening. On with the show.
Good morning. I come from Kla'amen. Kla'amen is the nation that is the furthest north of all the Coast Salish territory. What brought me down here was the invitation by a number of people to come and hear and share the story of, you know, the importance of forestry. So I wanted to share that story just a little bit, because a lot of the people that I met on this journey, this chapter that we're in right now, was through Fairy Creek. Fairy Creek watershed, for the last 3 years, we have been doing our part to stand up and defend the old growth. And we've been winning one step at a time, one arrest at a time. 1,188 people have been arrested at Fairy Creek. Two of us Indigenous elders have been standing and supporting and advising our land defenders, because we recognize that our forests are important. We have the last of the old growth for a portion of southern Vancouver Island. That is what draws us together, connecting us very closely to Oregon, to California, through to Seattle, you name it, all up and down the coast. So I want to welcome everybody. That's a very short story. I want to welcome everybody to the ancestral lands of my relatives, because in the Indigenous language, we're all related. Siam, my cousins, my grandchildren, my brothers and my sisters are on this land. And so today I come here with a little bit of an honor to say welcome. Welcome to this very important discussion. So, haichka siam gelakasa.
My name is Anna Mae Leonard. I'm from the Clackamas Band of Chinook, Kalpuya, Wishram, Klickitat. Those are Columbia River tribes. I'm enrolled Grand Ronde, but didn't live there. I follow the Warm Springs and Yakima ways. I'm the co-founder. Maybe some of you remember our battle with Nestle and Cascade Locks for Oxbow Spring, yeah. So I'm the co-founder of the Wanapum Fishing People against Nestle, and we won. We won, yeah. Sometimes we win. And I want to acknowledge, though, the environmental groups, Food and Water Watch, the Cascade Locks Water Alliance, and BARC. They battled with Nestle for 8 years. Thank you, if any of you are here, yeah. And before the tribes even knew about this, we didn't even know about our spring, our precious spring that was about to be commercialized. This is one of our baskets, our huckleberry baskets. Baskets probably 100 years old. I want to show you what an empty basket looks like. This is what an empty basket looks like because our huckleberries have been commercialized for the first time. In the late 1800s, we didn't have any say-so when they commercialized our salmon. We are a salmon people, deer, roots, and berries. We still have 9 different roots that we keep secret. We don't want to see them sold in the health food stores or anywhere. These are our sustenance foods. The tribes had all agreed, the 4 tribes, the Warm Springs, the Yakima, the Umatilla, and the Nimiipuu, or Nez Perce, as you might know them, from the Columbia River. We had agreed, the tribes had agreed, once the salmon got commercialized, that the tribes would not allow, the people would not allow any of our other foods to be commercialized, our roots and our berries. And then they snuck it in. About 10 years ago, I didn't find out till about 6 years ago, that our berries had been commercialized. Now you have Tillamook, the huckleberry ice cream, Umpqua. They have huckleberry cheesecake. And you see huckleberry products. I'm asking everyone to boycott those products. Don't buy those products. It's really heartbreaking. Every year, we go up and look for berries, and there are none. They're gone. And it's not the migrant workers' fault. We recognize this. They weren't the ones that are selling huckleberry permits. And as Native people, you know, we lived in balance with all of life on Earth from our beginning of time and from time immemorial. We've been gathering these foods, our sacred foods, to sustain our lives. But we don't just think about our lives. We think about our relatives, the bear, the eagle, the deer, the salmon, all the bird life, all the animal life that depend on those huckleberries as well. We always leave enough for them. When the commercial pickers pick, they take everything, everything. We spend hours and hours, $300 we spent in that one trip and didn't find any berries. They're gone. They're in Tillamook ice cream. Call Tillamook Umpqua. Let them know. Let the Forest Service know. Stop selling huckleberry permits. The Mount Hood Forest Service, they don't sell them. That's just the Mount Hood District. Out of respect for our tribe. You know, our ultimate goal is to stop the permits. But we also realize, you know, it goes against what we call our traditional laws. We don't really have a word for law like that in our language. But there's something called the traditional law. And by our traditional law, we cannot exchange money for our traditional foods. We cannot trade money for our sacred medicines that I will not name here because they are too sacred to name. And our huckleberries are sacred. And to see the look on my friend's face when we went to her family spot, that from time immemorial and for generations in modern times, generations, her family has picked there. And to see her sob, it was really hard to listen to her sobs in that mountain because there were no berries. And it like kills a part of you for us, for our people to see this and to see the looks on the people's face in our longhouses. And there's no berries. My friend's son's funeral, there were no berries on the table there for his funeral. And next, then they'll go after our roots. It was bad enough that we lost our salmon in that way. We still have to struggle for our rights. We're planning a rally on the 11th of October. I will get some flyers and information to you folks by the end of the day here. We'd like to have all the support, you know, that we can get, and that we can, you know, get a clear message to Tillamook, to Umpqua, clear message to Forest Service in Washington. And that's where our rally will be, at the headquarters. We'll march from the Tillamook headquarters, which is in Portland on Airport Way. And then we'll go to the Forest Service across to Vancouver. So thank you very much. Atawi Shamash, love you.
Okay, I'm gonna say my introduction in Navajo. I like to start off with y'all hearing some original languages that are not English. Yat esh e brenna tubes yinishye. Twada jitni nishle. Ta jitni dashiche. Wana gire wangshik bashishchin. Staining raksu dashinele. Akot ego dne ado ho chunk ado standing rak astan nishle. So I just told you all my clans and who I am, where I'm from. I'm from, in English you call it Flagstaff in Arizona. I'm also from Black River Falls, Wisconsin. And I am a Ho-Chunk, Diné, or Navajo, and Standing Rock person. And I'm the lead coordinator for our Keep It in the Ground program at the Indigenous Environmental Network. And currently, I live here in Portland on the lands of the Multnomah, Clackamas, Kalapuya, a lot of other tribes that if I name them, we'll be here for the rest of the day. So thank y'all for joining us today. And yeah, I don't know if Thomas, you wanted to? Yeah, okay, cool. So I'm gonna start us off by talking a little bit about why IEN is here, why we're doing the work that we're doing, and give y'all a little bit of a background. So IEN historically is an alliance of indigenous peoples, and our shared mission has been to protect the sacredness of Mother Earth from contamination and exploitation, the extraction of natural resources, and we are doing this by respecting and adhering to indigenous knowledge and our natural laws. So we've been here for a long time. Few centuries. And for a lot of that time, for 500 years, we have been in confrontation with colonizers who have come here. And it's always come down to the land, and through the land, greed and money. And that is definitely like an opposing view from what we're taught and what we're born into, that idea of like owning the land and the fact that you could try to make a profit off of it is something that is not part of our upbringing, or historically and culturally has been part of our societies. So as a result of, you know, the colonization in general, and specifically looking at land that has been stolen, we're now facing our current environmental crisis, and that threatens the survival of life, of Mother Earth, of all the beings on there, of us, and of our next generations that are going to come after us. So some numbers that I like to share with people are that 80% of the world's biodiversity is held by indigenous people, but we make up, what's the statistic, is it like less than 2%? We make up less than 2% of the world's population, but despite colonization and genocidal practices, we've been able to take care of and steward the biodiversity of the world, 80% of it. And at the same time, this huge amount of greenhouse gas emissions that have been put out into the world annually, if you look at the numbers, you can see that 86% of it is caused by fossil fuels. And yet, none of our climate policy ever seems to address that. Fossil fuels are not mentioned in the Paris Agreement once. Fossil fuels were, in fact, in our historic climate agreement, the IRA that was passed last year has, in fact, doubled down on false solutions rather than to address the real problem, the thing that emits 86% of our global greenhouse gas emissions. So one of the really awesome tools that my program has been working on recently that we've been trying to speak with our communities about has been this initiative that it's got a really long, complicated name that no one's going to remember. It's a Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Initiative, which is a really complicated way of saying stop fossil fuels now. and it's based on the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which was enacted some decades ago in a way that laid out clearly for countries who are part of the UN a way to take care of the world and also its people. So the three main pillars of this fossil fuel nonproliferation treaty is the first pillar is nonproliferation, which means basically that we're going to stop planning all of these future projects around fossil fuels. So that would mean stopping, can't believe we're still fighting this, so stupid, the Dakota Access Pipeline, that which is still being talked about now, and others like the Mountain Valley Pipeline. So those are still being built, but they aren't currently in action at the moment. So that's the first pillar. The second pillar is to stop all current working projects. So then that's the second step, is making sure that we aren't using any of the current oil and gas and coal projects that are going right now. And along with that comes a third pillar, which is what we're talking about, a just transition, a just and equitable transition to clean and renewable energy. And the reason why this project is so awesome is that when they're talking about this just transition, they've really thought deeply about how to make sure that we're taking care of the people who are most affected by all of these extractive projects. And so they do not support energy like nuclear, which is not considered a clean energy by the initiative, and it's not considered a clean energy by IEN either. and they are also basing a lot of their just transition on how we can really focus on uplifting and enacting indigenous rights and our sovereign rights.
Thank you, Brenna. Brenna has been an awesome colleague to work with. Her fierce desire to keep fossil fuels in the ground is inspiring. California, which is one of the fourth largest economies in the world, has recently signed on to the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty. By Brenna being one of the head leads in organizing that and demonstrating that this is needed on a global scale. So thank you, Brenna.
With help, Thomas.
My name's Thomas Joseph. I grew up not too far from here. I am enrolled with the Hoopa Valley Tribe, which is located in the Six Rivers National Forest of Northern California. We are forest-dwelling indigenous peoples. Our land has always been a rainforest that has changed dramatically due to deforestation of the redwoods and deforestation of the inland empires as well, forest empires. I am also Shoshone Paiute. My father is an enrolled member of the Lone Pine Shoshone Paiute tribe of what we call Paiute, the land of flowing water. It's known today as Owens Valley, which has been stripped of its water to supply Los Angeles with the ability to be the large city that it is. I grew up on the Clearwater River, which is a contributary to the Columbia River here, on the lands of the Nez Perce. I grew up there. I have a lot of family and friends that are Nimi Pu, and it was a good teaching instructions that they've taught me to also understand their connection to place and the importance of protecting our environment and our lands and our waters. And honoring the reciprocal relationship Indigenous peoples have always had with their land. growing up, being connected to that land, which was not a land of my own, gave me a foundation of understanding that we have that ability. We have that ability to connect to place and how important place really is. And the responsibility that we all carry as Indigenous and non-Indigenous to protect place, to honor the sacred, and to understand that the importance of that reciprocal relationship that we have with our Mother Earth. And that is one of the reasons why I am so inspired to be here with you all today, because this is a room full of people that are dedicated to protecting the sacred, that have dedicated, I have been on the front lines with many of you. I was very active in the LNG, stopping the LNG pipeline in Southern Oregon. Congratulations, the hard work of everybody in this room and beyond. Contributing to that. And so I see you. I know where your hearts lie. I understand that you too now have ancestors buried in these lands. And with that comes a responsibility to be accountable to the lands that you walk on, to the water that you drink, and to the air that you breathe. And to come into Portland and witness the drive, the ambition to call out this dark force for what it is. It's a lie. We understand that colonialism is a root cause of climate change. Science will tell you it's fossil fuel, and it's right. Fossil fuel is creating climate change. But it's based on the foundations of colonialism. It's based on the foundations of white supremacy. It's based on the foundation of capitalism. And so if we are to address climate change at scale, those foundations need to be challenged. And it's not going to take market mechanisms. It's not going to take capitalism that we see that's going on inside the halls of where our research assistants were or in the halls of the UN. That's just a further continuation of colonialism. Yeah. Living in Hoopa, I was working for our fiscal department for our tribe, and I seen our first carbon market being introduced to our community. And I was kind of shocked. I was like, that's a lot of money. You know, it was, I think at the time, $38 million. And I was like, that's a lot of money. And it kind of sounds too good to be true. And growing up in a matriarch society, in a matriarch household, I'm one of 10 children. I have 5 sisters, so it's a little intense. You know, you take this information and you speak to the matriarchs of the community. And they told me, if it's too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true. So dig into it. And so now you have a corporation that is asking us to offset their pollution so that they can continue business as usual, that they can continue to emit their emissions and continue to cause harm to our tribal members that are near their factories. And so our people wouldn't stand for it. Our people said, no, we're not going to allow that to happen. We're not going to allow our trees to offset you so you can continue to harm not only our Indigenous community that lives near your refineries, but other people of color as well. So the Indigenous people in the room, I focus on taking a lot of these carbon market trainings to Indigenous peoples because they're the ones that are being targeted. It's the Indigenous lands, like my colleague was saying, 80% of the world's biodiversity is in the tenure of Indigenous peoples, yet they're a small percentage. And so for the global North to continue their reign as the global North, as these empires, they need access to those biodiversities. And so they're targeting those Indigenous communities with projects like forest offsets, nature-based solutions, 30 by 30, because they need to access that unceded Indigenous lands. So one of the greatest things that you can do is uplift and support the rights of Indigenous peoples, their sovereignty, their right for self-determination, their ability to protect and defend their lands. With that, we can start being able to create more space for climate change. One of my task at hand working for the Indigenous Environmental Network is to talk about carbon markets and fault solutions. That's kind of what I do. But the question always arises, what is the climate solution then? If you're saying no to this and no to that and no to this, what are you saying yes to? My colleague Brenna spoke to it earlier, is an Indigenous just transition. But equally important, is there something that existed for thousands of years, an Indigenous women economy,
Indigenous female and femme economy is the solution to climate change. Not only has it worked here on Turtle Island, but it's worked globally. I encourage you to learn more about that. That's not my forte. I talk about fault solutions, but just in case somebody wants to ask me what the solution is to climate change, there you go.
I do want to open up some time for some Q&A, but I also want to share some information that was recently released in The Guardian from another research assistant, Adrian. He took 500 carbon offset projects and tried to classify them on where they line out. And they said that 78% of them are categorized likely as junk, which means they result to no reduction of emissions. That they're worthless due to one or more fundamental failings that undermine the promised emission cuts. 16% of that looked problematic, with evidence suggesting that they may have at least one fundamental failing and are potentially junk. And the rest of the 6% that was left over, there wasn't enough information being provided to make an evaluation of that. And that's just really where we are when it comes to carbon markets. Carbon markets are a false solution. They're a distraction. It's a false sense of hope. And there is many EJ communities across the United States and globally that support net zero targets and support carbon offset projects. And we, as the people that are on the ground, the grassroots community, must hold these EJ communities accountable. We must hold these big EJ orgs like the Sierra Club and other ones to let them know that the grassroots community, the frontline community, will not be a part of an organization that allows these false solutions to continue to move forward.
And we'll have to leave it there for today's episode of Coast Range Radio. You can listen to the entire Indigenous Environmental Network presentation by searching for